From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And let's get the latest on North Korea, which is threatening the U.S. territory of Guam with a missile strike. North Korea's military said via state-run television that it hoped to send a serious warning signal to the U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson spoke this morning from Guam.
I think Americans should sleep well at night. I have no concerns about this particular rhetoric of the last few days.
Joining us now for the latest is NPR national security correspondent Mary Louise Kelly. Hi, Mary Louise.
Hey there, Jeremy.
And Tillerson says we should sleep easy. He said the international community has had a pretty good week when it comes to North Korea because of the sanctions that were passed over the weekend. But then yesterday, as we've now heard time and again, President Trump said this.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
How do we square those two statements?
Well, it is a challenge, isn't it, to figure out how to square fire and fury the world has never seen with sleeping well
right.
at night. I mean, on the one hand, this continues the mixed messages we have heard on North Korea, where what the U.S. position and strategy for North Korea is seems to depend on which member of the Trump administration you talk to last. On the other hand, Tillerson was careful today. He did not contradict the president. He defended the fire and fury warning. Tillerson said this is the president just trying to speak a language that the North Koreans will understand, that they don't understand diplomatic language. I mean, don't forget, Tillerson is the U.S. diplomat in chief. So what we heard from him today was trying to calm the waters, trying to create some space for diplomacy. I mean, what he told reporters on the plane with him is he is hopeful that the U.S., along with its allies, can persuade North Korea to, his words, reconsider the current pathway that they're on.
And Tillerson was speaking from Guam, which I guess was a refueling stop on his way back from Asia, but let's talk.
It was kind of crazy to watch him pop up in Guam today, of all places.
Right.
As you say, it was scheduled, but I think a lot of people did a double take.
Well, and let's talk about Guam, which is a U.S. territory in the Pacific. It's home to major U.S. military bases. What exactly is there, and why is it strategically important?
It is. It's an island, just to give people a little bit of a sense of the geography. It's about halfway between Hawaii and the Philippines. It is home to about 160,000 people. They are U.S. citizens. As you said, this is a U.S. territory. Among the people who are there are some 6,000 U.S. military. The U.S. has a naval base there. It has Anderson Air Force Base there. This is one of the bases that serves as a launching pad for the U.S. military in the Pacific. The U.S. flies bombers out of there, out of Anderson Air Force Base. So they are used to threats from North Korea because it is it's U.S. territory and it is within reach of North Korea's missiles and has been for a while.
And what more are we learning about North Korea's missile capability as it stands right now?
Well, we are learning that their missile capability is advancing and advancing rapidly. The most recent insight into that came last month. In July, North Korea tested two long-range missiles, one on July 4th, the second one on July 28th. And, of course, U.S. military and intelligence analysts pore over that data as it comes in, the satellite imagery, they're plotting the trajectory, they're trying to figure out exactly what kind of capability North Korea is building. Now, there are questions, many questions remaining about the accuracy of those missiles, questions about whether a missile that if North Korea manages to get a nuclear weapon that can sit on top of one, which it looks like they've made rapid strides in that direction too, if such a weapon could survive reentry into the U.S. atmosphere. So a lot of questions there and questions about the size of the nuclear stockpile, which is an entire separate issue.
And Mary Louise, the people that you're speaking to, are they seeing what's going on now as more of a march toward some kind of military action or toward talks with North Korea?
Well, military intervention is on the table, as it has been for the Obama administration, the George W. Bush administration before, the Clinton administration before that. But it is a last resort because we know that this risks retaliation. It risks escalation. I mean, the problem with a military intervention is that if the U.S. strikes first in the name of avoiding nuclear confrontation, you risk sparking the very confrontation the U.S.
Right.
was seeking to avoid. On the other hand, diplomacy is a hard track forward. You don't even have agreement met between Pyongyang and Washington over what would be required to come to the table, what the prerequisites for that would have to be.
That's NPR National Security Correspondent Mary Louise Kelly. Mary Louise, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, President Trump's fire and fury threat eerily echoed August 6, 1945, when President Truman announced that the U.S. had dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan.
If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth. Behind this air attack will follow sea and land forces in such numbers and power as they have not yet seen.
3 days after Hiroshima, 72 years ago today, American forces dropped a second bomb on the port city of Nagasaki. A total of over 200,000 were killed in both strikes. And now there's an effort to more fully account for what happened to those people after the threatening language, after the bombs dropped. Reporter Hal Burton of the Seattle Times joins us from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Hal.
Hello. How are you doing?
Well, I'm good, but what a somber topic. We're reminded that the plutonium for that bomb at Nagasaki, Fat Boy, was made at the Hanford Reactor outside Richmond, Washington. A new national park is being planned in Washington State to commemorate the work of Americans who it's thought, you know, brought the war to an end building those bombs. Others, of course, have pointed out that the Soviets were invading Japan at the same time. That might have had as much effect as the bombs. But the park is called the Manhattan Project National Historic Park. Congress approved it in 2014. Tell us about the push to include the Japanese perspective.
Well, the park is being created in three different locations, Hanford, Los Alamos, and Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Los Alamos, New Mexico. These were all hubs of the effort to develop the atomic bomb. And as the park was being talked about and proposed and then through Congress approved, the Japanese were very concerned that there would be a national park created about bombs that destroyed two of their cities. And at that point, Park Service officials reached out to them and said, this isn't going to be a park just about the creation of the bomb that somehow celebrates or glorifies the bomb without looking at some of the consequences of what happened when the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Well, and you remind us, I mean, there was, with good reason, I mean, many historians agree that the bombs that, you know, killed 200,000 in Japan also may have saved many more Japanese and American lives by ending the war. But, you know, this darker side of the effects of the bombs we don't often hear about. So what might be included?
Well, I went to Nagasaki in May to get a sense of their museum there, which looks at really what happened underneath the mushroom cloud. I was actually really struck how the story that you now find at Hanford, where the park is operated in cooperation with the Department of Energy, sort of ends with the successful explosion of the bomb. Their museum begins with the cloud as you enter. They're showing a loop of it endlessly, some film that was taken of it. And I met with survivors, and there are thousands of them, and they tell really chilling stories of what happened as they lost family, friends, and loved ones in that explosion.
Right.
And it's not, the Park Service is not trying to just show that and not tell the whole context of the war. The thought is that there will be a look at the debate over the bomb use and all the reasons that people did think it was important.
The Hibakusha, the survivors, are in their 80s now, but you met one who told you how he begged his mama if he could go to the store with her. That's the only reason he survived. Over days, all of his siblings died from the radiation. And there's some unity between those who suffered in Japan and those who helped make the bomb in Washington State. They're called downwinders, do we understand? They died of radiation-caused cancer here.
The downwinders are people who lived in the area and actually got involved in a long lawsuit over the effects. There are also workers who are separate from the downwinder who suffered effects, and there was a compensation program. So certainly the development of the bomb, it's taken a toll in the Hanford area as well. And, of course, this is really now one of the most polluted nuclear sites in the world and certainly in North America, and the site of a major decades-long cleanup.
Yeah. So will their story be included?
That is the goal of the Park Service to tell all sides of the story. They pride themselves as being the nation's storytellers, taking on increasingly controversial and difficult topics. It still remains to be seen, given the budgets and the budget cutbacks that are happening in the Park Service, just the timing at which this story can be developed, or I guess to a certain extent, till it happens, it hasn't happened.
Yeah. Seattle Times reporter Hal Burton on plans for the new Manhattan Project National Historical Park, actually three parks, and whether or not to include what happened after the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the telling. Hal, thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you're flying to Europe this summer, you may have noticed some new flights from discount foreign carriers. The Danish carrier Primera Air recently announced new routes from Newark to London. Norwegian Air recently announced new service from Denver to Paris. The airline is also expanding flights in Austin and Chicago. And Iceland's WOW Air recently started flying from Chicago to Reykjavik. So what's happening? And are these cheaper flights here to stay? Seth Kaplan is managing partner of the industry trade publication Airline Weekly. He joins us from Washington. Hi, Seth.
Hey, Jeremy. Good to be here.
It's great to have you back. And why are we seeing so many of these U.S. to Europe flights from budget European carriers?
Well, there's a lot of demand for leisure service between the U.S. and Europe. I mean, that is the fastest growing segment of the marketplace. You know, corporate travel is the higher yielding part of the business, basically, you know, higher airfares, but it's not growing as rapidly. And so, you know, these airlines are trying to kind of go where the growth is. It's not a new concept. It's been tried a number of times over the decades. Cheap fuel prices are helping somewhat this time. Airlines think that, you know, when fuel is cheap, sometimes things that might not work as well in another environment can work.
Does that mean that when fuel prices go up, if they go up eventually, that these airlines are going to be in trouble?
Well, that's the big question. And you know, if you just sort of look at the growth, you might think, oh, these airlines must be doing really well, right? But, well, you know, Enron was a really big and growing company, right? We know how that ended. Now, Norwegian, to be clear, is not Enron. I mean, they're providing a very real service, actually great for consumers. You know, there are people who are able to travel, you know, from a U.S. perspective to Europe, in some cases for the first time, who could never afford to do it before. The problem is that the company's not really making money doing it. You know, looking at their earnings here in the past couple of quarters, they're likely to lose money this year. That's despite fuel prices being as low as they are. And so you'd have to think that, yeah, if fuel were to go up, you know, anything beyond just a little bit, they could be in real trouble.
Now, whenever I see an airfare that looks too good to be true and you start digging into it, usually ends up being too good to be true. There's some other fee or something like that. But I looked at Norwegian Air. I just picked some random dates in September and looked at Providence, Rhode Island. They fly direct to Belfast in Northern Ireland. And it was $238 round trip, including
Amazing.
All the taxes and fees. How do they even do that? Usually your taxes to fly to Europe are as much as that.
Yeah. And it is the law in America for the past several years that when you advertise a fare, it has to be possible to travel at that fare. Now, to be clear, that doesn't include food. It doesn't include checked bags. But yeah, you know, as long as you pack light, you can really do it. I mean, the answer is that, you know, they can't make money charging everybody that, you know, the lowest fare has to sort of be, you know, balanced by some higher fares for people, you know, maybe booking at the last minute, for example. But you know, right now they're just trying to develop a market like that because you know that hasn't existed before, and you know, hope that word of mouth helps them build the market. But they do have to count on at some point something changing because right now, although they don't break out their earnings by market, you know, and they also have an operation, a short haul operation within Europe, you know, very much like you know what Southwest does within the U.S. You know, it's fair to guess that if the company's not doing all that well, and if they're doing something else that kind of does make money for their competitors, you know, airlines like Ryanair and EasyJet in Europe that make a lot of money and don't fly across the Atlantic, this transatlantic service probably isn't doing all that well.
How is a carrier, another low-cost carrier like WOW Air, going to compete with somebody like Norwegian when you fly WOW, you have to stop in Iceland on the way to Europe?
Yeah, and their advantage would be in some of the secondary markets, you know, where Norwegian doesn't compete. You're right, Jeremy. You know, a nonstop flight is always going to win in terms of convenience, right, at least, over a connecting flight. Now, sometimes people will connect to save money, but it's pretty hard to save money over those kinds of fares that you mentioned. So WOW is, to a degree, going to have to specialize in markets where there's probably never going to be a nonstop flight. You know, let's say Baltimore to Bristol, England, right? You know, which WOW can offer you on a connecting basis. Norwegian's probably not going to offer that nonstop. So, you know, in that case, you know, that is the most convenient way to travel between those two places, perhaps. But WOW, by the way, also has the benefit of, because of its geographic position. Now, there are limitations when your home market is Iceland, you know, a rather small local market. But one benefit is that the geography is such that you can fly smaller aircraft deeper into the United States than you can from anywhere in continental Europe or even the UK. And that's important because, you know, sometimes you can fill a smaller plane, you know, whereas you might not be able to fill a larger aircraft. And Norwegian, in most cases, is still flying these Dreamliners across the Atlantic where you have to fill, you know, nearly a few hundred seats. So WOW does have that benefit of being able to use what you might call lower risk aircraft to penetrate the U.S. But it, too, you know, has a lot to prove. I mean, these airlines are all trying to do something that lots of people over the years, I'm talking dating back to, you know, Sir Freddie Laker many decades ago, or, you know, some people of a certain age can remember People Express collecting, you know, cash on board for tickets flying from Newark to London. Been tried many, many times over the years and has never succeeded on a sustained basis. So, you know, as a consumer, you certainly root for it to succeed. But the burden of proof is still very much on the airlines who are trying something that hasn't worked until now.
Well, and how are the legacy carriers, the Americans, the Uniteds, the Deltas, going to respond to this? Do they have to lower their prices for transatlantic travel?
They can't just ignore it because, I mean, these are fares that are in the marketplace. Now, look, you know, a time-sensitive business traveler who has to, you know, get from New York to London for a meeting and has to know that there's going to be, you know, if the meeting goes late, there's going to be another flight 2 hours later. If the meeting ends early, there's going to be one they can hop on. You know, that kind of person is not probably going to be considering Norwegian. So Delta, United, and American don't have to go toe-to-toe with Norwegian on those kinds of fares. But, you know, these are seats that are in the marketplace. And, you know, at the right price, all kinds of people will consider them. And in fact, Delta is already offering what it calls its basic economy fares. So these are fares that are even more restrictive than usual economy fares. Don't come with an advanced seat assignment. They're completely non-refundable. You can't even, you know, pay a change fee, for example. It's offering those to Europe and you know, very much doing it to compete against airlines like this. And the difference now is that airlines like Delta, as well as American and United, are rather healthy airlines, you know, which wasn't the case even, let's say, a decade ago. So it's not like a Norwegian can come in or WOW can come in and others and just kind of eat their lunch. You know, they have the deep pockets now to sort of withstand a war of attrition, really, in a way that Norwegian itself perhaps doesn't. So it'll be interesting here to see how this shakes out, because these airlines, the incumbent airlines, are very much digging in for a fight. They no longer see this as they perhaps once did, as, you know, just a completely different market segment that they don't have to think about. You know, they don't compete for all of the same passengers, but there's a pretty broad swath of the population that's up for grabs, and they're going to grab whatever they can of that market.
Now, I want to ask you about one more thing when we're talking about low-cost carriers, which is that you say that what's happening in Fort Lauderdale tells a story about what's happening with the industry overall, that there were almost no long-haul routes or flights there 10 years ago, and now it's totally different.
I used to live there, and I remember this odd kind of bluish purplish 767 for a few years was landing. It said Zoom on the side of an airline called Zoom that was flying between London and Fort Lauderdale, and it was one of the last of the airlines to have tried this sort of thing. And then during the fuel price spike last decade, that finally put paid to Zoom, and for a number of years there was nothing of that sort of service. Now, when you go to Fort Lauderdale, it's just one example of this sort of thing, but a very dramatic one. You know, you have Norwegian flying by a few weeks from now to six different cities in Europe, you know, Stockholm, Copenhagen, Oslo, London, Paris, Barcelona. That's pretty good. I got all. I thought to myself, I'm sure if I could name them. And others, you know, there's a Brazilian low-cost long-haul airline called Azul. And yeah, that's blue. If that sounds like JetBlue, that's because the founder of JetBlue went down and founded that airline there, flying from Sao Paulo up to Fort Lauderdale. Others, too. And so, yeah, it really is a changed world. All kinds of new options for travelers, which is why, you know, you hope that this, from the perspective of consumers, can work out. You know, Norwegian says this time is different. You know, they say forget all those experiments that didn't work in the past. You know, aircraft technology and so forth have changed things this time. And, you know, so far, their profits aren't really there to sort of confirm that. But let's watch here and see what happens. Definitely a very exciting time for consumers in all kinds of cities who, yeah, you see those fares and they don't seem real, but they are. You know, pack light, maybe have a sandwich before you fly. But yeah, you really can go to Europe for, as you said, in some cases, a little over $200 round trip.
That's Seth Kaplan, a managing partner of the industry trade publication Airline Weekly, and somebody who can rattle off airlines route maps just right off the top of his head. Seth, thanks so much as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Two destructive tornadoes ripped through neighborhoods this week in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and in Salisbury, Maryland, with no tornado warnings. So what happened? Well, that gets you into a big debate in tornado circles. Weather service forecasters are providing less advanced notice for tornadoes than they did 5 years ago, and they're more frequently failing to detect them at all. But there are also far fewer false alarms. Are those truths connected? And what about the fact that these forecasters may be wrestling with a different kind of tornado? Let's bring in Victor Gensini. He's a professor of meteorology and a tornado researcher at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Illinois. Professor Gensini, what do you make of these stats? Less detection and later.
Well, this goes to one of your key points, is this new type of storm. And one thing that we've been noticing with some recent radar upgrades, which is the major tool that forecasters use to issue warnings, is we're detecting a lot of these brief circulations. You know, a lot of storms have some degree of rotation, but not all produce tornadoes. And these forecasters are seeing things sort of underneath the magnifying glass, and they're kind of asking themselves, should we warn for these?
Well, because these are the QLCS storms. What does that mean?
Quasi-linear convective system. It's a fancy word of saying this is a thunderstorm line with embedded circulations within it.
Right.
And these tornadoes can develop within minutes, almost in between our observation capability. So, you know, these forecasters are really they're wrestling with these things of how to provide warning to the public.
Well, and somebody might say, well, why not just give a warning and then find out later? And that gets us into something else that may be happening. You're aware of Harold Brooks. He's at the National Severe Storms Lab in Norman, Oklahoma. It's part of NOAA. He says what's going on is psychological, that there's been such a crackdown on false alarms that forecasters might be worried about calling a tornado if it isn't one.
Well, that's right. We get into the discussion of probability of detection versus this false alarm rate. You know, do you warn on every single circulation that you see on Doppler radar? Your probability of detection is then 100%. You never miss an event. But if a tornado indeed does not happen, you've effectively cried wolf in the eyes of the public.
Right. And people may not react when there really is one. Hence the crying wolf analogy. Well, the false alarms has gone down from 80 to 70%, but so has the advance time. It's gone from about 13 to 15 minutes to about 8 in the last 8 or so years. And detection has gone from about 65 to 75% to 58% in 2015. That's pretty low, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the thing that we're seeing there is, again, underneath the magnifying glass, we're seeing a lot more of these circulations than we ever had before, you know, and no tornado now really goes undocumented. Everybody has a cell phone, they video these things, they send them into the National Weather Service, they spread on Twitter like wildfire. So these recent events just remind us, you know, we can always learn from them. They're great case studies, and just to bring awareness to the fact that we need more research. We need more policy of how to go about really tackling these from a warning perspective, because we're not sure how the public is consuming our information when we say, okay, there's a tornado warning, but it's going to be very brief, or it's going to be very short-lived, but it may cause damage.
Victor Gensini, professor of meteorology and a tornado researcher at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Illinois. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
We were lucky enough to spend some time with Glenn Campbell. It was 2012. He was on tour, backed by his three kids, saying goodbye to his fans.
God bless you. Thanks.
He just released a new album, Ghost on the Canvas, which reflected the disease, Alzheimer's, that took him yesterday at 81. We'll play a part of our 2012 conversation with Glenn and his steadfast wife, Kim. The complete version is at herenow.org. You can hear the Alzheimer's, although, and this is one of the blessings of the disease, Glenn often couldn't. Okay. So how you doing?
Good. Fair to middling, as they say in the country.
I would think, from what I've read, you're doing better than fair to middling. I mean, your concerts have been extraordinary. How are you feeling about this reception you're getting?
Oh, they're wonderful. That's been my life, just playing and singing. I've picked that out.
You have had an ear. You have had a way of picking the songs that there's something in them, mm-hmm. and people love them. Mm-hmm. But these concerts are sold out. For the first time in my life, I bought a ticket from a scalper to go tonight. I mean, are you feeling that? Does it feel different this time around?
Yeah, it does. Everybody is just wonderful. And it's, hey, Campbell. You know, they say, I say, Mr. Campbell, and I say, call me Glenn.
Yeah.
That's easier.
Well, and I love watching you on the Grammys. You had these young bands like Band of Perry doing your songs.
It's snowing, that's your door.
And I loved at the end, they left the microphones open, and you just kind of said, what should I do? Should I leave, or should I just shut up?
Thank y'all. Thank y'all so much. Where do I go?
You want me to leave now, or just shut up?
But
that's all live, isn't it? I didn't even realize that till I got through.
Well, what I was feeling from that is how comfortable you are on the stage.
Shut up! Like...
I am very comfortable on the stage. It's a something that I do, and I've done, my God, for, you know, what 50 years?
50 years? Yeah. Is that what's helping you maybe? I mean, there are some people who would have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and they would just, I don't know what they'd want to do. I mean, maybe someday I'll find out. You know, they'd want to crawl under the covers or something. You decided to do a tour. Is that because mm-hmm. you are so comfortable on the stage?
I didn't really think about it. I haven't seen any change on me that I know of. If they said I had it, the doctors, I guess they can be wrong, you know. I don't know if they are or not, but I don't feel anything. I don't think anything. I don't worry about anything.
That seems a lot like, I'm just going to say, the Glenn Campbell I know, which I don't know you, but I feel I know you from the television show and from all the recordings. Mm-hmm. That feels like, if I got that right, Kim, that's maybe, you know, why worry about it might be
a
Glenn.
He's always a really positive person, and he enjoys life, and he's always doing, you know, I think being on stage and out touring with his kids is exactly what he wants to do.
But did you worry about it?
Yeah, there were times when I worried, you know, should we be still out there doing this? Would it be better to retire? But from what I've seen, the more he's does what he's always done, the better he is. The more he's on stage singing and playing and enjoying life, the less evidence I see of the Alzheimer's. So
you just go out and do it, and you know something's wrong going on, but I don't know what it is. You know, just do what you got to do when you get there. And my dad told us that. You know, do your work, do what you have to do, and then fine, go do whatever you want to do.
You know, you mentioned your dad. I wonder if we could go back in time a little bit, because we just finished a terrific book on the Wrecking Crew. The LA-based studio musicians, you were one of them. I mean, a lot of people don't know you were this sought-after session player. And we read in the book that one of the reasons that you became a musician is that you were one of 11, I think, 11 mm-hmm. kids.
12 kids.
Dad was a farmer. Mm-hmm. You were a little kid, and you were hiding from doing your chores, and you went under the porch, and there was a snake under there.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yes. You talk about hitting your head, getting out.
Well, basically. You sort of... you sort of ran away from there. I mean, it was sort of like, I do not want to be on, I don't want to be a farmer, you know? And
no, gosh. I actually started out with Dick Beals and Sandia Mountain Boys, and that was, I must have been, what, 15, 16 years old, something like that. And it was on the way out of
Albuquerque.
I finally got to Albuquerque, right? Then I couldn't spell it, right?
You know a song about that.
Yeah, we got a song about it, yeah. Albuquerque, and that's all it says. That's the Albuquerque Spoco. Spoco, it's Albuquerque Polka.
Well, you make your way from there to L.A. You're with these terrific session musicians. You're a superstar of session musicians. Hal Blaine's on drums.
Oh, yeah.
Leon Russell,
yeah. All of them. That was the best band I've ever played with. They could really play.
That's Glenn Campbell playing with the Wrecking Crew on the Beach Boys' Help Me, Rhonda. We also spoke in 2012 about his new album, the title song Ghost on the Canvas by Paul Westerberg. I asked Glenn what that meant to him.
Like the ghost on the canvas, da 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 da. I like what it says. Maybe there is a ghost out there, I don't know.
Well, it's about people that sort of being between two places, you know.
Is that what that is?
Well, you tell me. I know a place between life and death for you and me. Best take hold on the threshold of eternity.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Da 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 da.
Best take hold on the threshold of eternity.
Da da da. Like a ghost on the canvas.
And see the ghost on the canvas.
People don't see them?
Yeah, people don't see them. That intrigued me with that.
It's one of those songs can mean so many different things to different people. Like a canvas is what you put your art on. So your art is your soul.
Mm-hmm. That's
long
true.
After you're gone, your soul is still there.
Well, good.
In between here and there, there's a place that we can grow.
I wonder, too, if it's a song for anyone getting older and reflecting on being closer to one place than they were when they were younger, but still in the other place. Is that making too much of it, you know?
I take it one day at a time.
Don't worry about tomorrow.
And what was the other?
Tomorrow has enough worries of its own.
Right. And I said, well, that makes sense to me.
A song you wrote for the new CD is called A Better Place.
Oh, yeah, A Better Place. I got that from a saying. I know there's a better place than this, but we ain't found it yet, or blah, blah, blah.
Julian Raymond, your producer,
Julian Raymond
wrote all those songs
right
with you. When he was recording Meet Glenn Campbell, Julian kept a journal of things that Glenn would say to him throughout the day.
Right.
And then Julian took those sayings and put them to music.
So
they do reflect a lot of what he's been going through for the past few years.
Yeah.
I've tried and I have failed, Lord. I've won and I have lost.
Wow, you are a pleasure to be around.
Oh, well, thank you. Pleasure to be around you guys.
I'm sure, Kim, that there are some days that are hard. But I don't think there are many.
Not very many, no. He's just a happy person, you know, and he's fun to be around. He's in fact, he challenges me because I wake up a little bit grumpy. It takes me a half an hour to get, and he wakes up just happy and singing. And
you know, Dad said to me something, don't cry over spilt milk. You know, I remember that when I was a little kid. My chore then was, because I was a little guy, milk them cows, Glenn, and I got a whipping for it, for spilling the milk, you know, as they say.
It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk.
Glenn Campbell in 2012. He died yesterday at 81. Our full talk and our conversation with Jimmy Webb about Glenn at hereandnow.org.
And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds and the ink stains that are dried upon some line. That keeps you in the back roads by the rivers of my memory. It keeps you ever gentle on my mind.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said today Americans should have no concerns after North Korea and President Trump traded fiery threats.
I think the president just wanted to be clear to the North Korean regime that the U.S., you know, unquestionable ability to defend itself, will defend itself and its allies. And I think it was important that he deliver that message to avoid any miscalculation on their part.
That was after President Trump threatened North Korea with fire and fury like the world has never seen, and North Korea threatened a military strike on the U.S. territory of Guam. Joining us now is Greg Jaffe, who covers national security for The Washington Post. Greg, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And how are you reading the president's rhetoric and what Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, is saying today?
You know, I think it's clear what they want the end game to be. They want to push the North Koreans to talks, and they want to convince the North Koreans that they're serious and that there need to be talks. And so it seems like all of the efforts with regard to their messages and the messages to China are designed towards that end.
But are they sending a mixed message? When we hear about fire and fury, that doesn't sound like, now join us for talks.
It doesn't. And it sounds different than the way previous presidents have talked. And I guess we can sort of debate the wisdom of it. But that does seem to be the end game. And, you know, in the past, I suppose presidents would say that they were promised a proportional response, I think was the phrase Obama tended to use. But certainly, I think the notion that there would be a military aspect to it is critical. You mean that's what's going to drive them to the table, the idea that there's a military alternative that's on the table.
You've been writing about the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, and the challenges that he's facing this summer. Do you have a sense of what his advice might be on North Korea?
You know, it's hard to know because he hasn't talked about it. Clearly, I think he believes that the North Koreans need to feel some pain and they need to feel a little concerned about the possibility of military action. And so those are, I'm sure, the things that he's pushing. I mean, McMaster, through history, you know, he's a big believer in American power and American strength and that, you know, we have to operate from a position of strength. And I think that's where both he and the president are trying to maneuver us right now.
So take us inside the debate that's going on about national security inside the White House. What is the conflict then between McMaster and advisors such as Steve Bannon?
Yeah, I think on North Korea, there's not a big conflict. Mm. I think the conflict tends to come in more on other issues. You know, North Korea, there's a sort of a limited path there and a really serious threat. So there's, I think, relatively universal agreement and not great options. A place where there's disagreement and not great options is probably in Afghanistan, where there seems to be the sort of greatest division or the most clear division. And I think McMaster is a big believer in, you know, we've been at this for 16 years, that this war is winnable. It's going to require some extra resources, a firm commitment, and some time. And I think the Bannon and some of the other nationalists within the administration don't see it as worth the time and the effort, and either they'd like to pull out or try something radically different. Then I think there's a third category, which involves folks like Secretary of State Tillerson, who's somewhere in the middle.
And where does Trump come down, or do we know yet?
I don't know. That's the interesting part. You know, Donald Trump says two things on this sort of simultaneously. One is he says, you know, he wants to win, which suggests strength and resolve and commitment. The other thing he says is he wants to get out. So as we wrote in the piece, he sort of wants to do more and less at the same time. And that's a pretty serious contradiction. So how he squares that, how McMaster squares that remains to be seen. My guess or my gut is that Trump is a little bit more towards the Bannon camp than he is towards the McMaster camp, or he would have signed off on this strategy. This debate's been going on for months and months now.
The Wall Street Journal has an editorial today about this fight and came awfully close to calling for Bannon to be fired. They said Bannon has been responsible for much of the White House dysfunction. Is it likely that either Bannon or McMaster ends up losing his job because of what's going on?
I don't think over Afghanistan, just because I don't think Afghanistan, despite the huge amounts of money, despite our great long history there, it's just not a front burner issue. It's a sort of second burner issue. But it's interesting in this debate because I think it clarifies the poles of the debate. And I think we're likely to see the same issues come up again and again in places like Iraq and Syria. You know, Mosul's been liberated, or ISIS has been driven from Mosul. The Islamic State will soon likely be driven from Raqqa. And I think there will be a big debate about what kind of presence do we need to have in these places to ensure that the Islamic State doesn't come back. How concerned should we be about successor organizations to the Islamic State? Because if the last 15 years have taught us anything, there will be a successor organization to it. And I think that's where you'll start to see, again, the same tensions that we've had on Afghanistan crop up again.
Is there likely to be a new strategy coming on Afghanistan?
You know, I don't know. I think, yes, they're working towards it, but it's been months and months, and it feels like we're a little bit at loggerheads. The same thing with regard to the Islamic State. I don't know if you remember when President Trump was first inaugurated, he pledged, you know, within 30 days, he told the Pentagon to come up with a counter-Islamic State strategy. The Pentagon produced a document. But that document hasn't been formally signed off on either. It was sent to the White House in March, but that's still being debated. Will we have a formal counter-Islamic strategy as well? I don't know.
That's Greg Jaffe, who covers national security for The Washington Post. Greg, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young.